Yes. 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 What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to another brand new Rugby Master podcast. I'm your host, as always, TJ. In this episode, which is episode 122, we are joined by Chris Cervantes, strength and conditioning coach over at the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma. Formerly strength and conditioning intern at the University of Texas, University of Colorado, and the University of Denver. This guy knows his thing when it comes to strength and conditioning. And that makes for a really, really good episode where we discuss the complete dynamic nature of coaching athletes in sports, let alone a sport that's as dynamic as rugby, where we've got so many different components that we want to improve upon to make us a better player. This discussion goes quite a few different ways, and I think that you guys are really, really going to enjoy it and hopefully find it really, really valuable. Speaking of things that you'll find valuable, you can find the show notes and you can pick up 50 free rugby conditioning sessions at rugby-muscle.com. You can also find out more information about our coaching and team Rugby Muscle. If you have been enjoying these episodes, it would mean the world to me if you could go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, or just take a screenshot and tag it on us on your Instagram stories and tag me at tj.strength or tag at Rugby Muscle from there. And yeah, that really helps us spread the word, because, you know, it's just me and I'm interviewing a bunch of different people that I hopefully are going to give you a ton of value. Speaking of which, let's get straight into this episode. It's episode 122 with Christopher Cervantes, strength and conditioning coach. All right, boom. So we are live with Christopher Cervantes.
Cervantes. That's right. Yeah,
perfect. There we go. We got it right. How's it going, mate?
It's good. Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Excited to be here. Excited to catch up and talk to you.
Yeah, man, it's a pleasure to have you on. I think you're our first like current college strength and conditioning. We've had a bunch of people that have like done it, got in and got out and gone and done other stuff, but I think you're our first current collegiate strength and conditioning coach. So it's good. Yeah, it's good to have you on. I've already bigged you up in the intro, but if you were to describe yourself with sort of like one sentence, like to our guests or to our listeners, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I used to grew up playing rugby, played a little bit in college, then a little bit after, wasn't very good at it. Was thinking I was going to do a career in healthcare, didn't pan out. Worked in healthcare for about 3 years, and I didn't like it. I didn't like the reactive approach to a lot of stuff, and I thought there was a lot of stuff that we could do, because I worked in orthopedics a little bit, and so it was looking at movements and thinking there's a lot of stuff we could do preventatively, and that kind of opened the door to kind of strength conditioning. And so I bounced around a few internships with Denver, then Colorado football, then Texas football, and then now I'm at Tulsa now, working with football and training volleyball.
Awesome. And so you only now train football and volleyball, or?
Yeah, right. So in football in college, you got 5 strength coaches. So I'm one of the 5. And then volleyball is like I have autonomy over their training.
That's like your baby.
Right, exactly.
And let's go straight into whereabouts with the football players do you work then? So if they've got 5, I'm assuming there's different areas. So you have your like a speed guy or
Well, we all kind of do this, like, so as far as general conditioning goes, we don't really separate it. And that's program to program dependent how your director wants to run it. Predominantly, like, I'm responsible programming wise for a lot of the newcomer developmental guys, and then as far as training the more like the veteran guys go, I'm generally working with linebackers and a couple D-line guys.
Interesting.
We don't kind of separate out so much though as in training like speed or power, stuff like that. We all kind of touch on that a little bit, whatever. But as far as positionally goes, like especially in season, we'll kind of break it up a little bit, just as we kind of see, you know, these guys need a little more of this work, a little more of that. But that just kind of pans out, not too much based on person. It just how we set it up.
No, I like that. I think that's way more preferable than having your speed guys and your conditioning guys or whatever, because that way you get complete control over the whole, you know, program for those positions.
Right, and it helps. You know, a big part of coaching in general is going to be a trust deal, and so having consistency with your athletes helps develop that trust.
Yeah.
So being able to be involved in different phases of their programming just helps keep you consistent, helps you build that kind of that rapport with your guys and build that trust in a little bit, and helps you as a coach. You know, you can regulate a little bit more based on, well, I know like I've seen how he's dealt with this or dealt with that, as well as injuries. Like, I know this guy's got a reoccurring. Like, we have a couple guys that have a bunch of AC sprains in the shoulder. So it helps me being consistent with him to know, okay, like, here's how I'm going to modify this or what I need to do to appropriately train for stuff like that.
I like that. And, like, what this is what previously worked for this dude in the past, and now I know blah, blah, blah.
Right, exactly. There's guys like, so another good point in that is, like, we've had certain guys that are, you know, for whatever reason, like, some guys can't axial load very well, just given the volume of reps they take, position, and stuff like that.
For our guys, do you want to just explain axial loading?
Yeah. So putting a bar on your back, right? Yeah. So there's certain guys that we just know, and vice versa, there's guys that we know that we can't front squat. They between, you know, the arthrokinematics of the lower extremities, they just have really long levers and stuff like that. So, again, just having that exposure, that repeated exposure, allows you to modify what you're doing accordingly, so that you know that you're appropriately prescribing exercise. Because you got to think, especially in the college setting, when we look at exercises, we don't think about it as an exercise as much as we think about what's the adaptation. Right. So I know that if I'm trying to create stress of the lower extremity, so we look at like a squat, so like back squat, front squat, or we have like belt squats here, for example, I know that I'm trying to create, whether it's I'm peaking strength, I'm peaking power, whatever it is that the main, you know, adaptive response of whatever, so the lower extremity, upper extremity, et cetera, you can know that I can still elicit the same response, but I just have to prescribe it differently based on the athletes.
That's massive, and that's massive for our guys to hear, I think, because you get it, in, you know, in this world of Instagram and all this sort of stuff, where you get people that are like, oh, here's how you can make sure you can do the perfect squat, or here's how you can make sure you can do this movement, or here are the movements that you have to do, and it's like, no, it's you work backwards. Like, why do you want to do this movement first?
Exactly.
And then
Does
it even work? Yeah, that's massive.
Yeah, and a lot of times I think, and I've been at programs where, you know, I was at a program where it was Olympic lifts was the gold standard. Everybody had to do Olympic lifts. And I asked the question one time, and don't get me wrong, I like the Olympic lifts, but I asked the question because I'd been in a program right before that where we didn't do any. And the question became, well, what are we doing them for? What is the reasoning behind what we're doing? Yeah. Well, what do you mean? It's football. You have to Olympic lift heavy. You have to clean heavy. And I said, well, why? What's the reasoning here? What's the logic? Well, that's just the way that it's been. I think what we're starting to see more now is as the field is growing and as the understanding of the field is growing, we're starting to understand that, again, exercises are means to an end, right? So if you start focusing too much on the exercise, remember, for a lot of these sports, like volleyball, football, they're not barbell sports, right? So the end goal isn't the movement. It's the transition onto the field. So if I'm not building you up to either prevent injury or increase performance on the field, I'm not doing my job, right?
Yeah.
So you could have the best squat form in the world, but if it doesn't translate, then I failed you as a coach.
Yeah, or if you know, they work so hard, especially with Olympic lifts, and I've had Olympic lifters on, and we've had this discussion, even those guys themselves will say it, like, you know, they're a means to it, like, for their sport, Olympic lifting, if they're in the sport of weightlifting, yeah, that's their goal. They've got to, you know, spend their time honing their technique and doing all that sort of stuff. But, you know, if you're spending 40 minutes teaching a guy Olympic lifting technique or squat technique, that's 40 minutes that they could be doing, you know, in rugby, passing a ball about or doing aerobic conditioning or other stuff. And
exactly.
Then you do other stuff, yeah.
Well, so. And then in college, it gets even more convoluted because you have, there's NCAA regulations. So I'm allowed in the off season, we get 8 hours total with our teams. That's a week. And then
they get
20 hours, but that includes practice, film, team meetings. So you're really looking at about 4 hours in the weight room max in season. So every second counts.
Yeah.
I don't get to make up that time. If I spend 40 minutes teaching something, I've eaten out, you know, at that point, almost 15% of my given time. What am I going to do with that? So you got to be really careful, especially in the collegiate setting, that you're not, you know, we call it time for efficiency. You don't want to waste too much time for efficiency. And you want to be able to get these guys, you need to get the results and be use your resources as much as you can, because you don't get that much time.
Chris, man, that's spot on. And I also think that still applies to, so like I've worked with a bunch of different, and I still work with these guys that are, you know, they're professionals. And they've got working jobs, they've got normal, regular jobs,
right,
and then rugby is a luxury. So it's the same thing, right? What's the point of us doing 5 3-hour sessions when I can get, you know, most of those results from you know, three 1 hour sessions, or even four like shorter sessions, even shorter than that. Like,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
And the other part you got to look at is if you're spending, you know, 5 3-hour sessions, you've got to accommodate for, like you're talking about, they got a job. There's stress is outside of your stress, right? You're just part of a greater equation of stress, right? So
yeah.
For these college guys, it's academics. For professionals, I mean, they've got families, they've got work, they've got, you know, true obligations and stuff like that. And you've got to be smart again with your time. They've got to be able to recover from whatever it is you're prescribing, in the sense that, well, how are we accounting for these other factors? How are we taking that into account?
Absolutely.
It's a whole system, right? We call it systemic stress. And the whole organism's got to work and be able to recover from that work. Otherwise, it's one step forward, three steps back.
Yeah, I always say that. And, I make sure when my guys, like if I'm with people that are working, that have got a major deadline and stuff, I'm like, right, we're deloading, because what's the point of us pushing too hard there? Because, again, yeah, stress is stress. And that's huge. And I think even with youngsters, like you said, at college, they still have to see that as well, right?
100%, right. Yeah, you got finals week, and that's part of, in the grand scheme of your planning, you know, your mesocycles and stuff like that, you got to be adaptable too. Like, there is no perfect program. You know, it can look great on paper, but you start going through stuff and you start seeing, and so you look at, you know, an off season when you're peaking maybe a little bit more force and stuff like that, but you have these other factors. Can you adapt the program? And then in season, you come off a game, let's say, and it's a more physical game. You know what I'm saying? Might take a little longer to, you know, maybe you have an overtime thing. Maybe you have a, you know, you're in a defensive deadlock, something like that, you know, where it's more tissue stress. And then you got to be smart about how are you going to adapt and accommodate to that?
Yeah, cool. So do you want to, let's go dig into that a little bit more. So do you want to dig into, like, well, first off, what are the NCAA regulations for off-season versus in-season that you're allowed? And then how you adapt the training to reflect either those regulations or, you know, the demands that you need?
Sure. So, yeah, so off-season-wise, and really for most sports, especially in college, you get kind of two off-seasons, because they'll tend to be, you know, whatever your main season is, and then you'll have, so for fall sports, so both my sports are fall sports, you know, we have our main season is fall, winter mm-hmm. off-season, then they'll do a spring ball. And it's kind of just scrimmaging against yourself and stuff like that. And so the rules kind of change. So in off-season, NCAA, you're allowed 8 hours. And that's 8 hours. They're not with position coaches. They're not with head coaches. That is pure strength, conditioning, or athletic performance, whatever the department's going by. You're responsible. So you're responsible for the conditioning aspect, and you're responsible for the strength training. So for a lot of us, we'll take our longest period away from main competition. So for us, that's the winter. Okay. We look at the winter and we say, this is when we're going to really peak, like absolute strength. That's generally when you max out, that's going to be like you're training towards new training maxes in the winter. Cause come summer, you're working a little bit more power, and you got to think about like risk reward. I can comfortably put some pretty heavy load on you in the winter. Hopefully you don't get hurt, you know, but if worst case scenario, somehow you got hurt, you've got longer time until competition to recover. Whereas, right, you know, summer is right before season, right before training camp. You get somebody hurt, you know, it's a quick way to get yourself fired. So, yeah, we look at that 8 hours in those two times. So summer, winter, and then both of them. You're looking at your annual plan, your mesocycle. You're thinking, this is where I'm really going to get after, you know, a little bit of energy system work, get your capacity back. You know, start with the first couple of weeks, targeting a little bit of that tissue response, or to building back up some sort of hypertrophy phase, building into, as you're working that capacity, you know, building up quality and stuff like that, movement quality, building into then peak force outputs. And that's going to be your heavy loads. And how you kind of diagnose that is you know, dependent on the person. We like to do, we do a little bit of a conjugate. Everywhere I've been, we've done a little bit of conjugate to kind of get both the neural and tissue response.
Yeah.
And then to do a little bit of just quality work by keeping you in kind of clusters and stuff like that, keeping the intra-set volume pretty low while driving the, you know, the inter-set volume a little bit higher. So example of that is, instead of saying, hey, we're going to do, you know, 5x5, 3x5, we'll do 5x3, we'll do 8 singles, maybe, you know, 6 singles as we build up weight, or maybe we'll do, you know, a cluster set of 4 clusters of 1 rep, rest 15 seconds, 1 rep. So it's still 2 reps in a set, but you're giving that time in between to let that alactic system kind of catch up and keep the movement quality a little higher. Because you got to be careful. Again, you got to look at when you start programming a little bit and seeing some of these heavier loads and these movement patterns, if you start diagnosing too high and intraset, you just see the quality of the movement. The body is just trying to survive.
Yeah.
Right. And so the movement quality looks like shit, and then you're losing the adaptive response you want because you're not patterning it. You're patterning just to survive. Then yeah, you kind of go.
Just so, so by patterning to survive, you mean like they're just trying to get that load up, however which way possible. They're not trying to move efficiently.
You look at a squat, and you spend a lot of time telling them, you know, don't. Well, we see a lot of, especially in the college setting, we see a lot of anterior tilt. We see the hip drops a little bit in front. It shuts off a little bit of the, so no longer is your butt, your glutes acting as a hip extensor, but now you're asking the quadratus lumborum, the QLs, which are hip stabilizers, you're asking them to try and act as hip extensors, which they're not. And then by default, you're also shutting off the psoas a little bit, and now the rectus, the quad's taking over a little bit as your hip flexor. And under heavy enough load, right, so you spend all this time patterning the right movement, under heavy enough load, and you know, you're always hearing this cue, get your chest up, you know, eyes up, stuff like that. Kids now hyperextended, anterior tilted, now they're driving out of their QL, and then you hear all these kids talk, oh, my back is tight. And then the response is always, well, it's just lifting heavy. Well, not necessarily. Yeah, there's some compressive load, and this is just a squat, for example. There's other examples of this, but yeah, you know, for example, there's something to be said about just compression of the spine. But there's also something to be said about what's your firing pattern? What are you asking the body to do? If you're just telling this kid survive, you know, for three reps under, you know, 85-90%, yeah, the body's gonna find a way to find you a result, but it's not gonna be the result you wanted.
That's massive. Yeah, that's like, and that goes back to already what we spoke about, which is, why are you training? Like, what are you training for? And if you're you're squatting so heavy that you're not using your glutes, which are going to be the biggest factor in, like, what they're probably the biggest muscle that you want to be training if you're doing any sort of athletic sport,
right?
Like, especially involving sprinting, you need to get those glutes working. So if you're squatting so hot, heavy that your glutes don't work, you ain't getting any faster. You ain't getting any benefit.
Exactly. So how are you prescribing that? So
yeah, man.
Being smart about diagnosing not only total volume but then also intraset volume. Just being smart in your approach and looking at, you know, you've got to prioritize quality sometimes over quantity, and making sure that you're getting that. And that gets into its own argument of you know, what is the appropriate dosage, and that has to do a lot with the training age of the athletes and, you know, how your exposure to them and stuff like that. But so then you go, you know, you'll peak that usually in about 7 weeks, 7-8 weeks. Got a deload week in there, a couple deload weeks in there. You're doing your run volume stuff, you know, your field work. And then when you hit into, so for example, if that was winter and you hit into spring, they go into spring ball. I think you get 15 practices in the spring. And that depends on how the coach wants to spread that out. I've been in programs where we did it in 4 weeks. I've been in programs where we did it in 5 weeks, spacing it out wise, and usually end up with the spring game and scrimmage. But so they switched back to the 20 hours. The 20 hours is, the athletes are allowed to do 20 hours towards, they consider it a team activity if a coach is present, okay? Uh-huh. And so then that goes into, so any meetings that they're in, any film that they're watching, practices, and your training. So your training, you generally take a back seat at that point, and you're going to be looking at anywhere from 3 to 4 hours a week with the guys working on, again, you know, just at that point, it depends on what you want to do. We do a lot of, at that point, we use that time to start doing intro power, stuff like that. Okay, yeah. We've peaked your max force. Now, can you move moderate weight with a little bit more intent, a little more speed? And then, so summer, same deal. You get your 8 hours. And then you'll generally spend about the first half of the summer, again, trying to retouch. Because you always look at your adaptations. You got to look at the residuals, right? So, okay, why do we train certain adaptations? Well, we know that we need, if we want to run faster, we got to first be able to put more force in the ground. Okay, great. Done that, and then the next step, and you have that capacity to get the work to get that result, then you got to look at, okay, you know, how quickly can I produce that force? But that's only as good as the retention of those qualities. Yeah. So you know that, like, max strength is what, 30 days plus or minus 5 aerobic base, 30 days plus or minus 5. So you got to retouch some of that stuff. And then, you know, kind of leading into the second half of summer, you generally going to focus on a little bit of power work going into fall camp. Which is kind of a meat grinder for most programs.
I was going to say, do you ever try and keep them fresh once they get into preseason?
That's a big thing right there. So, yes, we go into preseason. We look at a lot of, again, we intro power again. I guess at that point, I'm going to intro power. We're working power generally most of that time. And a lot of reasons for that is twofold. When we work power, in most, like, here, and again, in most programs I've worked with, if you do it in the form of accommodating resistance. So accommodating resistance is bands and chains. And the concept is when we reach end ranges of motion, so again, the squat's just an easy example, but as I come up, you know, I get out of the hole, I've overcome inertia, I'm coming up, I'm decelerating myself in space. And so I'm slowing down. I'm happy. If I don't, I'll displace, I'll jump. Right?
Yes.
But the natural is I reach that end range of motion, all right, you're seeing a lower angular velocity. Well, if we put bands and chains, we lighten you at the point of the most inertia, the bottom, the hole, where I've got to change momentum. I allow myself to then create a little more speed coming up, and then I've got to constantly overcome this new tension. So if it's chains, you know, as the chains come off the ground, more gravity acting on them, or as the band lengthens and the band's pulling on you, right? It's a new load, right? The load, the tension increase, the load increase. I've got to continually overcome that. So I've recruited the muscle. Now I'm continually recruiting, continuing these new velocities. But the other fold on that is it's less strenuous on the tissue and on the joint, right? Deep flexion for most of your joints is kind of the most wear and tear on you a little bit. So that's the point. We want to alleviate a little bit of that load to take care of the body. The other thing that we do is we call it soft tissue school. Yeah, we will spend a couple times a week in preseason and even in season, and we're doing soft tissue, you know, whether it's, we call it regen, so we're getting blood flow in there somehow. You know, we'll do myofascial release stuff. That's like your lacrosse balls, your foam rolls. And you can understand that a lot of that stuff, there's a true tissue disruption. You get a little bit, you know, in the first about 10, 15 seconds of it, but then it's a neural perception deal. So if you look at the studies, and look at the literature on a lot of that tissue release, you see that we learned a lot of it on rats. We were scraping rats, the grass and stuff. We released rat tissue. But think about the size of the rat compared to you, right? The amount of pressure that you're putting in there, even if you're being, call it as delicate as you want, the reality is it's pretty large amount of stress. So we even have tempering objects that we use. We use dumbbells, and we've got these big pipes.
Those big heavy pipes and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, they're about 120 pounds a piece, and we'll roll them up and down. But so some of that is a little bit of re-facilitating that fascial tissue, but some of it, the large part, is the nervous system. And that's kind of the big picture look at the body. The nervous system governs so much of what we do and its perception of stress. So the body doesn't like stress. It likes homeostasis. It doesn't care if you're playing sports, if you're out in the wild. It doesn't like any of it. So when we expose it to stress, its first response is, well, I didn't like that. I'm gonna try and shut all these movements down, limiting your range. Why people tell you, oh, I can't squat, you know, my hips, and then they foam roll, and 10 seconds later, you know, they're hitting the floor with their butt. And a lot of that is just you're putting in a perceived tension, which is telling the nervous system it's kind of distracting it in a way to relax, take tension out of this. So you put tension in, take tension out. So we do that soft tissue school with that. We'll do...
That's awesome. Like, let me just touch on that, the soft tissue school, because just all of that stuff in general, like the lowering the stresses and stuff, like... That's huge, because I've got guys that I train only for hypertrophy, and we'll still do a bunch of stuff on the bands just because it stops your joints from beating up. And for athletes, that means that you can play, you know, you can play more, or you can practice more at a higher intensity and not be so beat up. But even if you're just trying to gain muscle, that means you can train more frequently,
exactly,
maybe get
right
in a little bit more volume, right?
Yeah, and bands are great. So hypertrophy is not uniform, right? There's really two forms, but they're not mutually exclusive. You always have kind of one form kind of being a little more predominant, but they're both present, right? So you've got myofibular and you've got sarcoplastic.
Yeah.
And the difference is really just tissue shear, which is, you know, predominantly from your eccentrics and your heavier loads are really where you see that tissue shear. But the other side of that sarcoplastic, that metabolic response, all right? So you accumulate metabolites. Mm-hmm. That's that pump sensation. That's that cellular swelling that you're getting.
Yeah.
But it also drives, it's got a huge growth hormone response. Right, so that's why we use it a lot in rehab, because it's not taxing on the tissue. So we do it. You can do sarcoplastic hypertrophy with bands, right, full range of motion, or you can restrict. You can mechanically occlude. You can mechanically blood flow restrict in isometrics, right? Because when I, like, for example, if you've been tying a tie and you're sitting there for a while, and after a while your arms start to blow up a little bit. I don't know if that's ever happened, or if you hold a squat, right, the bottom of the squat.
Yep.
My hip is impinging a little bit of blood flow. So the leg, that's why Tabata stuff is so, you know, taxing, and throughout this burning sensation in my legs. We are restricting the blood flow in there to clear out those metabolites. You're getting that acidosis response. But it's not taxing on the tissue, really. It just feels like it is. You know what I mean? So it's another great way, right? So to push stress, right, without taxing the tissue. So like you talk about, you can train with more frequency. It's less you know, recover from it quicker. It's also why it's so big on rehab.
Yeah, and so you don't need to use heavy loads and stuff like that and get beaten up.
Right, and you're still getting this huge free-floating growth hormone response, which is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, so we use it sometimes on, like, auxiliary days, or we use it, you know, sometimes, like you talk about, like, deloads and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's massive. And then to go, and then in a soft tissue school with that, with a foam rolling and whatnot, like that, it's awesome to hear you say that, because I hear a lot of strength coaches that sort of swear by the foam roller, and they're getting fewer and fewer there's less and less of these guys, because I personally read it from, was introduced to it by Dr. Quinn Hennock, who's coming on the podcast.
Yeah,
soon.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, listen, if you think that this, like, pad of foam is actually really breaking up lots of your muscle tissue, what's happening if you're putting a, you know, 150 kilo barbell
right,
on your back?
Yeah.
You're just going to crush. You're just going to crumble into bits. So that's not
right.
how it works. But if it allows you to move, if it makes you feel better, and this is another thing that I harp on about recovery, is if you just feel better, then you're going to recover better. Like, if it just decreases that stress, then you're going to be good. And if that
100%, right, 100%.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of crazy thing about the body. You know, there's so much we still don't understand, but so
yeah,
much
man.
Of your perception becomes your reality. And we see this, you know, you look at neurology and stuff like that. And the simplest example is like you look at depression, right? A lot of people, you know, they're not born with neurotransmitter deficits, but whatever onsets that sadness, then it becomes a clinical issue. You actually have this true physiological response. Well, the same is kind of true for exercise and stress. Like, you have, you know, these placebo effects. So another one, you see the guys that snap the ammonia sticks before they go lift something heavy. If you look at the literature, the ammonia doesn't really work like that. You don't really get this adrenaline spike. The adrenaline spike is your perception of it working, and that's called, it's the same acute stress response as if you were in a game. You know what I'm saying? That same acute adrenaline spike, acute stress response, your perception kind of becomes your reality a little bit. So if you want to kind of control your stress, yeah, if that makes you feel better, you know, yeah, we're gonna refacilitate a little bit of slide with the foam roller, but pretty quickly it's gonna work or not work. But at that point, if you do a little more and it makes you feel better, hey, all the more power to you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's, yeah, don't stress yourself out trying to recover yourself or trying to, and just remember what it is that's making you better, and it's the movement, not
100%. Right, that's what's gonna stimulate the blood flow. Right, exactly. That's what's gonna move kind of that metabolic waste out. It's going to move the damaged tissue around a little bit, and it's going to allow, you know, the body to recover and refacilitate. It's going to let those proteins come in and do their job.
Beautiful. So to round this off, so we're getting now into preseason. As you say, that's, it ends up being a bit of a meat grinder for the guys.
Yeah,
how do you combat
you're
that
practicing, I forget the total numbers, but you're practicing almost every day. You know, you're working out pretty about three times a week, and you're just living, you know, for us, it's a time we're a little bit free of academics. You're just living football.
Mm-hmm.
Getting ready. And you got to think as a – whether you're a sport coach or strength coach, your idea is you're getting ready for season, so you're driving up. What, you know, what's worst-case scenario? How can we make sure the body's resilient for what's to come? Well, you treat – you know, you create worst-case scenarios and kind of treat the body to teach you how to recover that. So when they see that, they've got strategies. Then you enter season, and again, 20-hour deal, and then – you know, you look at it, for us, we look at it, and we want to keep the retention of strength for a little bit. So we'll, you know, start 60, 65%, build up, you know, over your progressive overload over time. We're still doing a little bit of conjugate work. So, you know, if you look at every program I've been at follows some form of a tier approach. But tier is just basically a way of looking at, you're hitting a total lower upper major movement, compound movement every day in some form or fashion. But you're kind of prioritizing your max effort stuff. So, like, for example, day one might be a total body max effort movement. That could be like a form of Olympic lift, or that can be like a, you know, heavy deadlift, something like that. With volleyball, I did trap bar work last year as their total kind of stressor. Because you're looking for a huge systemic response. You're looking at how can I tax, you know, multiple muscles, large muscles, because that's going to not only shear the tissue a little bit, but it's also going to get us a good response, you know, that you're going to drive that stress up a little bit. A systemic response, hormone increase, stuff like that, bone density and stuff like that, and soft tissue as well. And then you're gonna hit, you know, so if I hit a total major stressor, then I'm probably gonna look at my lower as a dynamic form, so some form of intent based something. So, you know, we're lucky we got tendos, we can look at bar speed, and so we'll accommodate it and we'll tell you, okay, like, we want you hitting about, you know, whatever, 1.1 meters per second or 1.0 meters per second. All that really is twofold. it allows us to auto-regulate a little bit on, you know, if you're right. getting bagged at, you know, at this weight, you should move at 60%, you should move at this speed. If you can't do that, okay, and that's not taking shots on you as the athlete, you know, that just means something's going on, stress, something's stressed, and the nervous system, we call it nervous system readiness, you know, isn't where it's supposed to be for whatever reason. It doesn't make any sense for me to keep throwing weight at you and expect, you know, a new result. That'd be insane. So it allows us to kind of keep an eye on your nervous system a little bit, back off if we need to a little bit, or vice versa. If you're on, you know, you don't get many of those days where you're moving crazy speeds. Let's pump you up a little bit. But it allows us to be explicit in our response and what adaptation we're trying to get. And you'll hit some sort of repetitive effort upper, and then that kind of just cycles, right? Once we get in season, we kind of switch to two-day lift because you're getting a lot of your volume out of your practice and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, generally, so the way that we like to do it is we like to do Sunday lifts or day after competition lifts or event lifts. And the reason for that is it allows us to get blood flow in there, move some stuff around a little bit, and it's furthest day out from next competitive event. So we're lucky, and rugby's kind of the same way, that you know that you're generally playing every, you know, once a week and about a week apart. You know, sports like basketball or soccer can get a little more convoluted, and you got to be a little bit more adaptive as a coach because you know that your competitions are a little, not only more frequent, they're not consistent. Volleyball, again, kind of lucky because they're Friday, Sundays until they hit in conference play, then it becomes a little bit closer, but still it's consistent enough. But yeah, you just got to look at your job as a strength coach predominantly. Like, we love seeing these PBs, we love seeing these records, these PRs and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, your job is first and foremost, you know, resiliency, injury prevention. So being smart in that approach. And a lot of that, like, you can look at strength as a great prehab deal, but at some extent, you just got to be smart in how you treat and how you respond to competitive events. But so we'll do, like I said, we'll do one lift a day right after competition, right after event. We generally give them the following day off, so because you have to give one day off a week in NCAA. So generally for us, that's going to be Monday, and then we'll have one more lift sometime during the week. You know, depending on schedules, and because we split up our positions a little bit.
Yeah.
And that lift there is more based on the notion of peaking the nervous system. So if you look at it as like a strength speed emphasis on your day one lift, where it's a little more tissue-based response, you're looking at a speed-strength response on your day two lift a couple of days. And that'll generally be like a Tuesday, Wednesday, where you're targeting more of a neural response because you know that you can peak the nervous system at about, you know, so if I lift something with some speed on a Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, about 4 days out, it's kind of like a bubble, it goes up and kind of peaks the nervous system and then starts coming back down. You got to retouch that neural response or you'll lose it. And the same with top end speed. That's why you got to look at sometimes practice plans. You got to at least once a week see top end speed or retain speed. It's a neural response.
That's awesome. I want to touch on a few things about that training week that I really like. And I don't always do this with a lot of my guys, but if we can, I think it's a great idea. But if you play your game on the one day, that's obviously going to be your highest stress of the week, right?
Right.
That's the most stress you're going to have. So you need, you know, as much time as you can to recover from that. But whilst you're there, yeah, if you then lift the next day, especially if the game wasn't as hard as you thought, or, you know, you didn't put in as much effort, you know, it wasn't a complete grinder of a game. Maybe you're, you know, especially in rugby, you're a winger or something and you only touch the ball a few times.
Right.
Then why would you not get in the gym and lift heavy ass or really like put yourself through a real tough session the next day?
Right.
Because then you've got 5-6 days to recover. And then you can take a full day off the day after that. And then you're recovering. Not only are you just recovering from the game, but you're recovering from the gym and you're getting better at it. Adaptations, and that allows you to make more progress in the season. So that's
100% right.
That's huge. And then that also, once you get during the week, then you're allowed. Then your training isn't just geared towards making like massive long term adaptations. It's about what adaptation can I make that I can then peak for the game. So it's not going to put me through the grinder anymore. It's actually going to perk me up. And it can help a little bit long term. Like, you know, if you're doing like nice power work or some high quality speed work, you're obviously going to make adaptations long term, but more importantly, you're going to make nice adaptations like short term and really peak for those games. So that's massive.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that, mate.
And that's where, too, you can kind of play around with a little bit. So, like, okay, I've got a 23-man roster, let's say, this weekend for a rugby game, you know, and I've got my 15 starters. Maybe those guys, you know, they come in off the bench. Maybe you got a guy that didn't come in off the bench at all. You know what I'm saying? Maybe he didn't need to come in that game. Mm-hmm. He was on reserve. Train that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got the time. They didn't get that stress response. And the body, like, it doesn't retain these qualities. You know, if your body's a business, right, it's not going to waste money. It's not going to spend energy to maintain a lot of these adaptations if they're not warranted, if you're not stressing them. You know, why is it, why am I wasting my energy on this? It's all about homeostasis. The body only cares about homeostasis. It's a survival reflex, right? So same way you got to think about a business thing that's spend money on a department that isn't producing. They're going to downsize that department. Well, you got to stress that, you know, whatever that is, if it's tissue, if it's, you got to induce that stress appropriately, but you got to induce it a little bit to retain it. Now, that works both ways. And if I have a high rep guy, you know, maybe somebody didn't come out of the game, right, stayed in that whole game. Maybe they played a pretty brutal game. I still want to get them in to move blood around a little bit, but I got to be smarter in my prescription on them.
Yeah.
You know, and whether that's volume or intensity, and that's kind of, you know, philosophy dependent on each coach. But, you know, again, it's just that auto-regulation, keeping tabs on your guys, being smart about it, and, again, prescribing appropriately. And that a lot of it just comes down to you as a coach.
I fucking love that analogy of the body being a business. It's so true.
Yeah.
And that's why we do conjugate training. That's why we train, especially, because you can do, like, there's obviously an argument for doing lots of speed, like high velocity work in season, because you need to keep training those qualities so that they're ready there for the game. But if you're getting them in the game, then you don't need to train them as much. So there's an argument to be said, like, literally both ways, where some people are like, right, I need to do high velocity, real high force stuff because I need that for my games. But at the same time, if you're getting them in your games, you don't need them, because that's you almost kind of training them and hitting on that department.
The most adaptable coach will be the most successful coach. If you can look at and understand, and that works both on the field and in the weight room, if you can look at the response and the adaptation versus the movement itself, like we talked about with the exercise, you got to squat this sort of stuff like that. If you can kind of take it at its core of what is happening, both systemically and tissue wise, and that's gonna give you the most. It lays all the variables out for you. At that point, it's just what recipe you're gonna use. You know what I mean?
Dude,
so gotta be adaptable.
Yeah, I love that, and what I love about that is that it can allow me to make a little cheap plug here, where it's like, look, that's why I do one-on-one online coaching, is because that allows me to really be adaptable to each player and their training week and what they need to do and that sort of stuff. And then the one program I do have, it's highly adaptable depending on what you need and where you're at in your season and what you need to do. So it's massive and that's awesome.
Yeah, and it goes too with training aids. Like, your more elite level guys aren't going to need. They're the body at that point is used to encountering, you know, high bouts of stress, so it knows to adapt quicker. Your less, you know, more developmental guys are going to need a little bit more, because the body just needs a little bit more that stimulus to warrant a response. It's still not used to that consistency of stress.
Yeah, and the older guys and more experienced guys have a little bit more wear and tear, so they need to prioritize recovery as opposed to the younger guys who can take a lot. That's awesome. Right, cool.
You can also look at it, too, like a lot of times, so we'll look at, we call you, you know, quote, elite, let's say, because there's a point of diminishing returns, and then that's true with strength. Yes, you know, you got to be a certain level of strength. So what's strong enough, let's say? We say, generally speaking, you know, if you're anywhere, you know, about 250 pounds or lower, and this is a pretty generalized statement, but if you're about 250 pounds or lighter, you know, what is that? Kilos?
Don't worry about it. They can work out.
Yeah, like, work it out, whatever. Oh, 114 kilos, let's say. We're going to say that, you know, if you're going 2.5 times your body weight in squat, you're probably hitting the point of diminishing returns. If we take you any further than that, you know, risk-reward-wise, that's a lot of load. So at that point, it's and then, so we talk about kind of our more experienced veteran guys. We've seen that you've peaked force output. Now, how quickly can you do it, and how consistently can you do it? Because remember, a lot of sports, right, are repeat output, the repeat efforts. Look at a game like rugby, right? You got to have a huge capacity. You got to be out there for 80 minutes. So can you do the same thing over and over and over again, right? That's the other aspect of it. It's not just how strong are you or how much force can you produce, but how many times can you do that? So that's too what we start looking at. You know, how strong is strong enough? You're over 250, we generally say about 2 times you're hitting that again, that same point. Risk-reward, you got to think, you know, it's got to translate, and I got to get you. It can't get you hurt. You know, if I get you hurt in the weight room, it's kind of feeding the purpose of my job of keeping you from getting hurt on the field.
And fatigue-wise as well, like that's what I say to it's like you've been listening to the podcast, because I say so many people, and Fitchie's like my perfect example, who was on a while back. He's now D1 captain at Glendale. But when I first did, like when I first started training him, he was like a D2 sort of bench guy. And what all we did was, one of the biggest things I did with him was we did a lot less, and we did barely any lifting at all. Cause I'm like, dude, you don't need to be stronger. Like, what use does it have you squatting 180 kilos versus you squatting 200 kilos versus you being able to just be that much more fitter and get around the pitch that much more? Like, right. That's where we want to target.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And that's where I think a lot of times, especially in college, the egos kind of come out. And I think that's where kind of the downside to a lot of the social media and the exposure comes in, is it's so much of, well, look what my guys are doing, how much weight they're moving and stuff like that. And we go back to, does it translate? You know what I mean? Is it getting them better? Are you really helping them? Cool, they did it one time. What's going to happen? You know, for football, what's going to happen 60 minutes a game? You know what I'm saying? How much capacity do they have to repeatedly do that? So that's, again, where you got to be careful. And as a coach, you got to be smart in that, you know, you're not doing this for pat on the back. You're not doing this to say, well, look what I can do. You're doing it for, at the end of the day, doing it for the athletes. That's your job, to be there for them. So what are you doing for them?
And the same can be said for the athletes. Like, what are you training for? Are you training to make a really cool Instagram clip or a nice little video that you can post so people can see how cool it is? Or does none of that really actually fucking matters whatsoever? It's actually about what you can produce on the pitch.
Exactly.
Yeah, dude.
Another thing that we'll do sometimes with more developed guys, you know, the more like your elite, your veteran kind of guys, is you look at bilateral strength. And you're like, cool, great. You produce a lot of force bilaterally. We know that sport is predominantly unilateral.
Yeah.
Right? You're generally on one leg. So with your more like your younger guys, your developmental guys, you got to spend more time doing bilateral work, because that just allows you to peak more systemic stress, because you're just moving more load. But your stronger guys, start loading them unilaterally. Start looking at what can they do unilaterally, whether that's, you know, upper extremity, lower extremity, stuff like that, because that's truly what they're going to play in. You know, what's happening, you know, kinematically in space? Are they decelerating themselves? Are they able to control that? Because that's going to be their biggest exposure. It's another way to manipulate. We're still getting a big stress response, but we're not doing it with load. We're doing it with a little bit more stability requirements and a little bit more that innervation and intent behind their movement.
Yeah, that's massive. I do so much more single leg work with my athletes now compared to what I used to do when I, you know, just didn't know as much, when I thought back squat was king or whatever. Like, right. Now, back squat, I do so much less bilateral squatting than I do, you know, rear foot elevated or even just reverse lunges. I do so much, like, those are more frequent in my programs than the actual bilateral squats, for sure.
It goes a long way. And the other thing you got to look at too is when you're on that unilateral stance, that back leg, whether it's a reverse lunge or a rear foot elevated, right? You're re-lengthening that hip.
Yes.
Right? We spend so much time hip flexion. What am I doing to re-facilitate the natural, you know, positioning of that joint, of that tissue, right? I'm allowing you. Yeah, I can stretch you, but what does that mean if as soon as you encounter stress, you've only created strategies to hip flex, right? Because in sport, especially if you're going to have any sort of speed work, you've got to hip extend. So re-lengthening out that hip for you a little bit, taking some of that tightness out by reteaching the body how to hip position-wise, it goes a long way.
Yeah, that's why I love that movement. I love rear foot elevated split squats for that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you get you a bigger bang for your buck. It's less weight. It's less systemic fatigue. You know, for hypertrophy or for single leg stabilization in terms of like sprinting, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I'm glad that you said that, man. All right.
Yeah. I mean, sport is unilateral at the end of the day. That's what we got to appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, everything is unilateral. Like, when do you ever in day-to-day life see yourself just do it? Like, do you know, just hop, jump around? Do you? Like,
no, right.
Everything is done with one arm or one leg at a time, or at least, you know, work. Even if they're working together, they're doing different jobs. So I absolutely agree with that. I think it's huge. So cool. Let's move on to some questions now that we have from our guys. First one, I just want to kick it off with an easy one for you to answer, hopefully, is the biggest problem that you see with collegiate athletes in general?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is the same at any level. I think as the level of competition increases, I think time management is always an issue. And that's always, you know, we look at, yeah, we can control your weight room stuff and stuff, like what you're doing outside of the mandatory minimums, I think, is where you run into a lot of issue. And that goes to that recovery, dieting, stuff like that. You know, the stuff that you would think would be second nature, I think, always is kind of the biggest hurdle we have to get over a lot of times with people that come in. And that was true even when I played. Like, I was poor at it. Maybe that's part of why I didn't do so well. You know, it was just, you got to really appreciate that all the stuff that we do in the weight room and on the field only works if you're doing everything else, if you're sleeping, if you're eating, well, you know, if you're recovering, you know, whether that's, again, a soft tissue school or if that's just on your own, what are you doing to refacilitate getting back?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And it's like, it's not even necessarily spending hours on a foam roller or doing any of that sort of stuff. It's just reducing the stress in general and being that.
Number one thing that we have trouble with, especially in the college setting, is sleep. Yeah. These kids do not sleep well. They don't sleep enough. And they think that it's some magic deal where they can just get by and it's not going to affect them. And then we start seeing, you know, that's going to affect your hydration status, right? The less sleep I have, the more energy I'm spending to just function, I'm becoming dehydrated. The more metabolism I'm undergoing, right? The more energy I'm consuming just to regulate normal body functions. Now I've got to now increase my food intake even a little bit more because I'm asking more of the body to do more. So.
Dude, that's fantastic. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because it's all very well and good, like, because sleep is always it's the least glamorous thing in the fucking world, right?
Right.
You're not doing anything. You're not interacting with the world. You're not doing anything. You're literally doing nothing. But it's in terms of bang for your buck, Jesus Christ, like
it goes so far, right?
Yeah.
And what happens a lot of times, too, like these kids, they leave and I'm gonna go to bed, but then you know they play on the phone for you know how long, or they're watching an iPad. They're not doing stuff to kind of prep that down regulation of the body. They're still staying upregulated by exposing themselves to screens and stuff like that. It's not allowing kind of that rest, digest, parasympathetic response to kick in. They're staying, you know, upregulated for so long, and then there's a huge latency to when they actually finally fall asleep. And so the sleep quality that they get, and we've done stuff. We've had, you know, different tracking systems that we've used on the guys to kind of show them, like, yeah, you laid in bed for 8 hours, but you really got about, you know, 5.5 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
You know, here's that data for you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's key. So getting rid of electronics around your bed, doing that sort of stuff always helps.
Definitely.
Cool. All right. Next question. Kind of on the flip side, I guess. What are some of the most common traits that you see with your successful athletes?
You know, now it's people are getting exposed to sports at such a young age, and not just sports, but now you look at like high school strength conditioning was not really a thing. When I was in high school, there was definitely not. And then you know, even once I started going to college, stuff like that, and started seeing it was still pretty, not primitive, but it was old school, right? It's old school mentality. And I think there's so much more education out there now, and stuff so the plus side to social media, the plus and downside, I guess, is the exposure. There's so much exposure.
Yeah.
So I think you're seeing guys that are coming in and they've been exposed to, you know, a lot of the, especially the Olympic lifts, the time to proficiency becomes less because they've seen them already. They've experienced it. There's a lot more information really out there. So I think the exposure to training. Now you got to be smart about that. Obviously, if you're in high school trying to go to college and stuff like that, you know, make sure that you're around people that understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. But I think what makes what we see a lot more successful is we just get kids coming in that are stronger because they've been exposed not just to training but to explicit training with purpose.
Yeah.
You know, so they haven't just been at the CrossFit gym down the street doing, you know, whatever. You know what I'm saying? They've been with somebody who actually understands, you know, some form of adaptation to help facilitate their field performance.
Yeah, that's huge. So it's not just – because that's the thing, because I think it goes both ways. Because you have the guys that have been exposed to it and they move really well because they're fortunate enough to have a good coach or whatever. But then at the same time, you have some of those people that are, you know, they're 13, 14, 15, and they just figure they can do it on their own because they've read a few bodybuilding websites,
right,
or something. And then they have shitty form, and now not only do you have someone that you know, hasn't got those good movement patterns, they've actually got bad movement patterns and probably a bad attitude, because it's a big old shot to the ego for someone that's
always
a freshman in college,
yeah,
to say, hey, listen, bud, I know you think you've been dedicated for these last five years, but you've been doing it poorly, and you know you're nowhere near where you need to be. So, yeah, it's a rough one.
It's an interesting dichotomy you got.
Yeah, because especially like some of those high school coaches, like high school weight room coaches, you know, they're just the old, linebacker from that school back in the day who was a beast. He doesn't really know shit. Like he hasn't got the education, hasn't got the qualifications, and
no, right. And sometimes they're so worried about, well, did the weight go up? Well, yeah, it went up, but like at what cost?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that was me. I'll be 100% honest. I think I was one of those dudes where, like, I just, we didn't have the social media that we do now. Like, podcasts weren't a thing, you know? So, nobody was listening to this. Podcasts didn't exist. So, I didn't know what I was. I just did the best with what I knew at the time. And turns out, like, a lot of that stuff was, you know, I was doing 200 kilo squats to about, you know, 2 inches of depth.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? I thought, yeah, man, I'm a badass.
I was right there with you. And that's kind of where I think the field is getting really interesting. I'm curious to see where we evolve. Things always go, they kind of swing back and forth. Like a pendulum always goes back and forth. So I think now we're seeing a big swing, you know, information, analytics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think we'll see down the line, it'll swing back a little bit. Too much analytics. I think we're seeing a little bit of that now. Why am I trying to force that?
For sure.
But, you know, there is something to be said about the field is progressing, and there's just more information out there. We just understand things a little bit better now than we did, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, when you and I were playing, you know, in high school and stuff like that. And I think we're getting a better understanding. So I think when you look at what are some of the things that I think that are giving these kids advantages, I think just the exposure to training. And the cool thing about a lot of this, so like, yeah, you have your high school coaches, but you also have a lot of places now, like Denver's got Landau's and a couple other spots now. These private facilities where they've got qualified people training youth athletes. I think that's going to be huge for us long-term in sports, and I think you're going to see a lot of that really pay out. A lot of the girls that I've had come in for this volleyball that have done really well, they didn't, you know, and they didn't work out in high school, they said, but they went to, you know, they played on a club team, and their club team had some deal with some facility down the street they trained with, and so they got that exposure. So it was less time spent having to teach them stuff. They understood it. We could get the ball rolling that much quicker. Same with, you know, football. It's a little harder because they want to work out with the team in high school, but I think, again, you have all these facilities now with qualified people teaching the right things.
Yeah.
I think it's going to help us grow.
Yeah, that's massive. I'm actually going to Landau's after this.
Great place.
Pretty cool. Yeah. The place is really impressive, but it's the staff, dude, that really impressed me, because all of those guys know what the fuck they're talking about. Because you see some of these other facilities, you know, because it's, you know, it's popular to have stuff that looks kind of cool. And you see these other facilities where there's people that just don't know what they're doing, and they're teaching people bad, you know, they're loading up bad movement patterns, and they're just making them run through a ladder as fast as they can, or just doing other stuff that they've just seen. They think, this sounds like a good idea. Yeah, let's not get started on the ladders.
Yeah. We'll
just rant for about an hour on that shit. But, it reminds me of when I was I was at first in my semi-professional club back in the UK, and our strength and conditioning dude, I was in college, so, you know, this is when I started to learn my own stuff and really dive deep into it. Our strength coach was just an old bodybuilder, you know, who was a decent enough player, and I was like, okay, what's he going to make us do? And some of the stuff was all right, but some of the stuff, you know, it was just done because it was just done. And I was like, fuck, man, this is... Yeah, it actually made some of us worse athletes.
We used to have these workout programs in college, and our strength coach in college was just our rugby coach. Great guy, great player. But I mean, you know, that wasn't his field, and it was just there was no consistency to it. And what was the program? That's not taking shots on him. I mean, that wasn't, again, he just didn't have that background. We just didn't understand. So it was it was a lot of random stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. What's the most undervalued area of college strength and conditioning, you think?
Most undervalued area, I think, is just, you know, you think that we're just, and to some extent, I mean, there are some, but like these meat sticks, you know, what do they really know? I think there's such a growing understanding of sports science and exposure to sports science. There's so much more to what we do and why we do it that I think sometimes it gets overlooked. And that's when we talk about, again, just the sleep and these, you know.
Yeah.
His movement patterns or stuff like that, or understanding, I guess, the large, big picture look. I think the most undervalued thing is, I think sometimes, like, what do we know? We're just a bunch of meatheads.
Yeah, yeah. We're not just trying to make you muscular or whatever. We're actually making you better players, even if you're already a fucking sweet player as it is. Like, we're not going to try and spoil that juju. We're actually going to enhance whatever natural talent you have.
Exactly.
Yeah, dude. I like that. So. That's a top answer. Cool. All right, last sort of deep question I want to ask you to round this off is we've had a few people that have been asking other coaches and other we've had doctors and stuff on how they shape their career in strength and conditioning, because we do have quite a few PTs that listen to this.
Yeah.
Have you got any advice for guys that are just looking into getting into that field and
doing? Yeah, 100%. So my background, like my undergraduate degree, nothing to do with strength and conditioning. I was trying to go into healthcare. I was trying to get into med school. Wasn't very smart, but I don't, for whatever reason, I thought I could do it. so my undergrad was in like general biology. You know, I think I had a minor in chemistry and some physics deal. And I got out. I didn't get in. I didn't know what to do. I spent some time in a physical therapy clinic. That's where I got into orthopedics a little bit, and that's when I kind of found out a lot of the information. Strength conditioning, it's not, I want to say it's the right way, it's not easy to learn, but it's not hard. Like the information's there. Like everything I know, I've taught myself.
Yeah.
So don't think that oh well, he just knows this, or he just did that because somebody taught him. No, nobody taught me. I had to teach myself from the ground up. But it's there. The resources are there for you if you want. There's plenty of people. Quinn Hennick was a great one. I actually took his course a long time ago, back in 2016. But I started looking at Quinn Hennick when I was still in PT, and it just helped me understand, kind of bridge that gap of like movement kinematics and performance. You know, there's so many resources now that if you want to get into this field, you got to put in the work to teach yourself. But I promise you, it's there. The first time I took my CSCS, I bombed it. I did terrible on it. This was in, God, I want to say 2013, 2014, and I thought, shoot, well, that's it. Like, this isn't the career for me. It would have been really easy at that point to just let it go. But no, if you truly have a passion for this, and you have to have a passion for this, because the hours that you work, you don't make a whole lot of money. You work, like I said, 47 weeks out of the year, I'm working 7 days a week, 80 hours a week. But if you love it, it's great. The resources are there. If you've got the passion for it, you can teach yourself all this stuff. You really can. And there's so many great people out there to learn from for free. On a lot of these big guys, like the Quinn Hennick has, I don't know how many lectures on YouTube that I used to watch, my lunch breaks at work. Cal Dietz and Lou Simmons, they got all their stuff, understanding how to manipulate the tendon response and create dynamic work and that free energy return. Mm-hmm. If you take the time to educate yourself appropriately, anybody can do this, but it's there for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. Like it, the only important thing I would say on top of that is to make sure that the guy that, you're learning from some sort of science-based.
Right. Exactly. Principles, yeah, evidence-based science practice always. Right. Because you got to be able to justify at the end of the day. And then that's where we look at those exercises. Like, we always, in the back of our minds when we write programs, have to be able to justify everything.
Yeah. And with science, that allows you to do it, as opposed to, because there are, there's lots of good free information. There's also a lot of shit free
really bad information. No, 100%. Yeah. And that's what really is kind of the hardest part, is how do you discern that? But if you look in the right communities, I guess would be the way to see. Yeah, you talk about evidence-based science practice stuff. Right. And then that's, I think you hit the nail on the head there with the science-based approach. 100%.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that does help. It helps a lot. And I also like the fact that you shed the light on the fact that it's like, even when you've made it, like you know, you've got you got your dream job almost here, and you are working your ass off. So it's not, it's not you going into a gym and starting your own sort of professional sporting career. Like, you barely have time to train yourself.
Right, exactly. I mean, there'll be weeks where you don't get that time, especially in season. That's just what it is. But a big part of being a coach is, again, it's not about me. It's not about what you don't want a skinny chef. I get that. I can't, you don't want the guy that's never worked out a day in his life. But at the end of the day, it's what can I get these athletes to, what can I teach them to do? How can I improve them? So, and you got to have that mindset, because the second it becomes about you, the ship has sunk.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. And I think guys will take great value from that. Cool. Last four little fun questions then that I always ask. Favorite supplement?
My favorite supplement will always be, what was it called? No Explode.
Hell yeah.
I started taking that when I was in high school. I like it. I don't know. It always worked for me. It, yeah. It clears my bowels every time, but I love it.
Yeah, that it could have. It may have wrecked my adrenal glands because of the amount I was taking. But fuck, yeah. I hit some PRs and I explode. Yeah.
It's just like, it just tastes so good.
It's just, that's hilarious. That's awesome. Okay, cool. Favorite gym movement?
I'm not going to lie. I'm a big squat guy, even though, you know, there's times and places for it. I love to squat.
You're a fan of the safety bar squat, subpar, right? Right? Your safety bar squat?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've been playing around now with, so we're going safety bar Hatfields, but instead of using like the hooks or the bar, we're using a band to make it a little less stable and see if we can't get a little bit more of a
Ooh.
A fast switch response. But yeah, I mean, I'll always love squatting in some way, shape, or form. It's just always, yeah. always what I do.
If yeah, anyone that follows you on Instagram after this will see that as well.
Yeah,
sweet. Favorite food?
My favorite food. I love Chinese food. It's not great for you. It's got a lot of MSG, but I can eat. But specifically, for whatever reason, it's the most basic, but beef and broccoli. I don't know. I've always
loved it. Yeah. My old housemate used to live on beef and broccoli, man. Beef and broccoli and squats. I like it.
My fiance, she's not a big Chinese food fan, so I haven't had it in a while. But I just, now that I got me thinking about it, the other day I was thinking about it, just like, man, I could really go for some.
Awesome. And then who's going to win the Rugby World Cup later this year?
Just because you're on with me here, Tom, I'm going to have to say England.
Attaboy. Yeah. That's the first person I think that's picked England.
we used to have Wilkinson jerseys in high school.
Really?
It was a while back now, but oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, if only we could have him, man. That would help us out.
That was a guy, you know, he was just another specimen of human.
Yeah. Just more so just his level of dedication, which actually...
That's what I mean, right. Like, yeah. I mean, that guy would play through anything and just... Yeah, he was what we call him, war daddy. He was a war daddy.
Yeah, absolutely a massive war daddy. Cool. All right, Chris, man, it's been an absolute pleasure. This time has absolutely flown by, and I'd love to have you back on. Where can people find any more information? Is there anything that you want to sort of plug? Any sources that our listeners can go follow you and stuff?
If you have any questions, if you feel free to reach out to me. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. I'm not one of those people that says don't contact me. You know what I mean? This industry is pretty open industry. So I know how tough it can be. So yeah, so my email is christopher.k.cervantes. That's cervantes@gmail.com. You know, shoot me an email if you have any questions. And then I'm on Instagram. I think it's just Christopher Cervantes, one word, is my handle. You know, if you feel to reach out, I'm not one of those people that, you know, don't contact me. You know what I mean? Let me know. Come talk to me. Come say hey.
Yeah, man. Awesome. Hopefully, guys, reach out to him. As you've heard from these podcasts, this guy is a wealth of knowledge. And so, yeah, use him. Absolutely. I'll plug all of those. They'll all be in the show notes, so your email and your Instagram, so people can reach out to you. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode of the Rugby Muscle Podcast, please feel free to share it with your friends or teammates. It's something, the little things like that that you can do that really do help the show grow. And the more we grow, the more we can help you guys out. Another thing that you can do is go ahead and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That only takes about 20 seconds. And it helps us grow and helps us spread the podcast to people that need it. If you're interested in stepping up your training, then visit rugby-muscle.com where you can pick up 50 free rugby conditioning sessions, or you can join Team Rugby Muscle where you get world-class strength and conditioning delivered directly to your phone. That's rugby-muscle.com for more information on all of that. Thank you guys for so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.